If your restaurant wants to put the best on the table, look for food with a New York State Certified seal. It's food that is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
I'm Greg Bresnitz.
And I'm Darren Bresnitz. We're the host of Snacky Tunes.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, Heritage Radio listeners. It is Tuesday at 11 a.m., and welcome to The Line. We are 1 week away from Election Day, so if you haven't filled out your absentee ballot yet, please do that and get it in. And also, please make plans next Tuesday to vote. It is sort of important if you've been paying attention to what has been going on lately in the United States. Now on to the fun stuff. My guest today is Jay Chan. He is the chef and co-owner of Fancy Nancy, which is named after his mother. It is a restaurant located in Bed-Stuy that, full disclosure, I've been to multiple times. I am a huge fan. I think it is a perfect neighborhood spot. You could eat there multiple times a week, and if you haven't been yet, you should go and check it out.
Thanks, man.
I feel like we hit it off the instant we met. We seem to be similarly aligned kind of in terms of how we approach hospitality and food and just having a good time while we cook. I want to definitely talk about Fancy Nancy, the spot in Bed-Stuy. But first, I want to start with your mom. The restaurant is named after her.
Yeah.
And your family is a restaurant industry family.
Yes, very much so.
Cool. So I know you were you're from Massachusetts. Tell me a little bit about your early childhood growing up in a family that owns restaurants.
Oh, man. It was fucking awesome. the first restaurant opened when I was in the first grade, so pretty early. And I guess, let's see, what was it like? Parents were at work a lot, so I understood, like, from very early on that it was just, like, you work and you come home and sleep. But
what type of restaurants were they?
So I get asked this a lot, and there's nothing really in New York that you can compare it to. It's very, like, I mean, maybe in, like, a suburb or something, but it's, like, a very Boston experience. It's just, like, a, you know, family-run Chinese restaurant. There's, like, you know, I was there, like, doing my homework at a table, you know. Mm-hmm. There's, like, prep work on a dining room table. They're, like, you know, but it's big. It's probably like 80 seats, 80 to, like, yeah, 90 seats. And it's like Pan Asian cuisine. There's, like, so there's two of them. The one in Boston has, like, a sushi bar. There's, like, pad thai. There's General Tso's chicken. There's, like, All the Chinese food that American people love to eat.
Yeah, isn't it kind of weird that somehow Chinese restaurants have become this sort of catch-all for the 25 American dishes that I don't mean American dishes, that dishes that Americans look for to
eat.
Yeah,
totally.
So it's like, don't you think it's bizarre that Pad Siu and General Tso's and also sushi, everyone's like, oh, yeah, that's just Asian food, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's such a, I don't know, that's everywhere, right? You go to
totally.
You go to a Chinese buffet and it's like they have sushi doesn't make sense.
I mean, across the street from Fancy Nancy is number one Chinese and Japanese, but it's really like the same bulletproof glass Chinese, you know.
Right, yeah.
With like fried shrimp and tartar sauce, obviously.
So growing up in the restaurant, you're sitting at a table, you're doing your homework. How early on did you get, were you bussing tables? Were you prepping? Like, when did you get thrown into the mix?
They put me to work pretty early. Mm-hmm. You know, doing side work, like, you know, cleaning green beans, like, packing to-go orders. I did that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
To-go business is huge, obviously, in Chinese food. So I was in the kitchen a lot, but not too. So the tickets, everyone in the kitchen is Chinese. They don't really speak English. The tickets print in, like, Chinese. I don't read Chinese, but
okay. Do you speak any other languages?
Yeah, I speak Cantonese.
Okay.
It's really rusty now, but Yeah, I helped out pretty early on.
And so when did your parents start it? And also, are your aunts and uncles and your grandfather started it? Or your aunts and uncles are involved in the restaurant to a certain degree?
So yeah, that first restaurant was opened by three partners. And that's one of them is my father. And then my uncle, who's my mom's brother. And a good friend of theirs. So it was those three guys started it. My uncle was a chef, like the executive chef of like this kind of local chain in Boston called Waylou's. And people just got to know him there. So the restaurant's actually named after him. It's called Billy C. And then aunts and uncles worked there. And then they decided to open another one like a few years later. My mom left her like bank job and started working there. Yeah.
And so how does that come about? Were they sort of recent immigrants to the United States? Were they born in the United States, and father?
No. So my mom was born in Canton, China, and my dad was born in Saigon in Vietnam. And then they moved to Hong Kong. They spent most of their time in Hong Kong before coming to America. So it's kind of a crazy story, but just how they
tell it.
So
here we are on the radio, I'm ready to hear it.
So my father is my mom's second marriage. Mm-hmm. My mom came to America through basically an arranged marriage with some guy who happened to live in America. So if it weren't for that, I'd be like some random kid in China, like just whatever, doing my homework at another restaurant, I guess. So they got here and then whatever, she met my dad.
Separated from the arranged marriage?
Yeah. Okay. Divorced from the mm-hmm. arranged marriage, which was like a huge deal in that culture. That was like fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Married my dad.
This is probably in the 60s or 70s?
In the 70s,
okay.
Yeah. And let's see.
And they're in Boston at this point, right? She was living in Boston.
She moved to Boston. Wow. She was the only one from her family in America. Finally, like, moved her family, like, her mom and her dad and siblings came.
So your mom seems like a real badass because...
She's a real badass.
That is an intense thing to go through,
yeah.
Both culturally, economically, also just American socially. Even at that time, getting divorced was probably not the most common thing. And then you're talking about someone who recently moved here. So that's a big decision to make.
Yeah.
So she meets your father, they settle down in Boston. How long after that does the first restaurant come about?
Years later. I mean, my mom and my dad actually met before. My dad was friends with my mom's brother, mm-hmm. When they were in Hong Kong. And, so when my uncle was working at this restaurant, Waylou's, my dad got a job there too as like a manager. So they were all, you know, already in the restaurant business. My mom worked like a night shift in like this, I don't even know what she did, in like an office of a bank, uh-huh. like whatever, counting money or something.
Counting money. Who knows what they do down
yes.
there. How, maybe you can't answer this question, but I'm curious, how important to the fabric of the community is a family-owned Chinese restaurant? It seems like you just said that everyone employed there, you know, they didn't speak English. Does it become sort of a spot for people who have recently immigrated to the United States to say, like, all right, I'm probably going to be able to get a job working in a restaurant because it's family owned and they're most likely going to hire either friends or family that are coming over to the United States. Does it work like that to a certain extent?
Some do. We didn't really. I mean, most of our family, my mom kind of has a big family. She, you know, she's one of five kids. They were all here. They all worked at the restaurant at some point. But most of the staff, like as far as kitchen staff, it's really, I mean, that's like an issue too, as it is in New York, just like finding staff. And they have to compete with like a lot of Chinatown restaurants, and like they're a little different because they're not in Chinatown. Mm-hmm. So it's really like not a lot of Asian people go to their restaurants, you know. But
oh, so it caters mostly to like a white suburban clientele.
Yeah, yeah.
Gotcha. So what is it like? You're a young guy. Your family has one, maybe two restaurants, depending on the timeline.
Sure.
You are in high school at this point, and they're both are open when you're in high school.
Yeah, yeah, for
and
sure.
And so you had told me that, you know, high school wasn't really your thing. It wasn't really working for you in terms of, like, being something that interested you and challenged you. And you said that there was, when we talked earlier, you said that there was a program run through your high school that piqued your interest in cooking a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that, like, was that home ec, basically? What does that really consist
basically
of?
Basically, it was a culinary program, and it was basically, like, the teachers would eat there. You know, they would, like, order from a menu and pay. So it was, like, on the top floor of the school.
So was it, like, a fully functional restaurant?
Yeah, basically, we did, like, the coffee cake and muffins and whatever in the morning. You know, the lunch periods, we would kind of, you know, like, cold-cut sandwiches and maybe a burger special or something.
Did you get paid or did you get credit?
No, it was just, it was, like, credits.
Okay, so it was sort of like a hybrid between, like, working in the cafeteria and also you were... So, but there was probably a chef, right, that was helping you make
items? There were, like, a few chef, like, instructors that were there. And, you know, we had some, there was, like, a classroom element of it. You know, we had some, like, written tests and stuff. But for the most part, it was really... I just, like, did a lot of dishes. I showed up to class
late. So you went to high school and did dishes, and then afterwards you went to your parents' restaurant, and they were like, hey, man, get back in there, do some dishes. It's your shift to answer the phones.
I got good at that.
So you're the entire aspect of your working, living, breathing day is sort of restaurants and cooking.
I like it in the kitchen.
So you are in this, you're in this kind of home ec program. You're working at the restaurant as well. At this point in your life, are you thinking to yourself, I'm definitely doing this as a career? Or does it just seem like this is, my family owns a restaurant and I have to work there?
That was part of it. I never felt like I had to work there. I think if it was up to them, I would have maybe been a little smarter and done something else with my time. But, and I really, I really hated school growing up. I think a lot of kids can say the same, but I was very passionate about not liking school. And I don't know if it was so much that I was like, oh, this is something I can do. I think it was just like I was doing it, and I just kept on doing it. And here I am.
So it does, though, you did make a actual hard decision to attend Johnson and Wales, though. So you do actually at a certain point say, all right, this may be a possible career opportunity for me. What's it like going to culinary school? I imagine your family was behind it to a certain extent. Like they were okay and with your decision, probably supportive to a certain extent.
They were okay that I was going to a school. they were like, at least he's going.
At least he's not wasting his time doing nothing. Okay.
They were a big part of it. I think if it wasn't, if I didn't have like Chinese immigrant parents, I probably would have just started working and gained some, experience in like commercial kitchens. But school was good. I mean, I didn't love it, but it was a good, it was a great place to learn from mistakes, other people's mistakes. For the most part, I worked during school too, and I when I think back about like experiences, I probably think about like the jobs more than what I learned in the classroom.
So after school, you end up going back to Boston. You go to Mistral.
So actually Mistral I worked at during high school.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How old were you when you had your first cooking job?
16.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was in high school, and I worked basically the pastry station. Mistral was like, like a fine dining restaurant in Boston. At the time, it was like pretty nice. It was like pretty fancy. And at that point, my family had, it's funny, kind of like following the evolution of my family's going out to eat. You know, it was like we would go to like whatever, like the local pizza place, you know, that was like going out. And then like the restaurant's starting to do a little better. We'd go to like nicer places. And so my parents really liked this place. We went there. They had like this seared Hudson Valley foie gras with a brioche like muffin that was hollowed out that was stuffed with like duck confit and like these dried Wisconsin cherries. And then, you know, it was like a little piece of like foie gras seared on top and then, you know, like a whatever, like a demi, you know. And I like ordered that every fucking time I went to this restaurant and the chef was like, who the fuck is this like little Chinese kid ordering, you know, foie gras every time he comes in? But I loved it. And yeah, one day I was just like, I think I want to like work here. I want to like see how this
did
stuff is
done. Did you
even
know what foie gras was, or did you just point to the most expensive thing?
Yeah.
On the menu?
No, no.
When I used to go out with my parents, my mom used to say, oh, you've got such great taste. You look for the highest number on the menu.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, well, if it's the most expensive, it's gotta be the best.
Yeah.
So I'm ordering like a T-bone steak when I'm years old. So you order the foie gras, the chef is so intrigued, and then what happens?
Yeah, so he would like come out to the table and say, what's up, you know? And one time I was like, hey, I think, you know, if you'd have me, I'd love to like just work here, you know, I'd spend the summer or whatever. And he was like, why don't you come back? We'll talk about it. You know, like,
So I
went back and it was basically an interview. I didn't even realize it at the time. But he was basically like, all right, come upstairs. We like walked through the kitchen. At this time, my experience in restaurants was really only my family's. Which was, you know, just like a Chinese restaurant. It was run very like, I don't want to say sketchy. I mean, it's like a, you know, but it was just like very chill. And then
perhaps not the same organization level of a fine dining restaurant in downtown Boston.
But, besides my family's restaurant, I would watch this show called, Great Chefs. It was on TV. And that was like my perception of fine dining, which was just like incredible mise en place and like a quiet, calm kitchen, and like the chef is just like making this beautiful dish one at a time. And
everyone's
then,
stark white. No,
yeah,
one has,
yeah, it's just like
no one has
a
drop of sauce on them.
Yeah.
Where does all the cooking occur?
There's no screaming. There's no nothing. And so, you know, he like walks me through the kitchen of Mistral, and it's just like, you know, a kitchen in the city. There's people like, there's pots banging, there's people like hustling. And I was just like, holy shit, this is like fucking crazy. And he takes me upstairs to his office. He like, you know, busts out cigarettes and starts smoking. And he's like, you know, I'm gonna work you like a dog and I'm gonna pay you pennies. Like, do you want to do this? I was like, yeah, sure, why not? Whatever. What else am I gonna do for my, you know, with my summer? So I did that. And it was great. It like, you know, turn my world upside down, and I loved it. It was great.
It's cool that someone who just hated school, you know, basically what he did was he conned you into basically going to school for free.
Yeah.
And you said, yeah, all right, I'll sign up for this. No problem. Yeah. I'll work basically for free, and you can abuse me as much as you
want. Yeah, as long as I can, like, stand around foie gras all day, I'm cool.
So you start to gain this new perspective on restaurants. Does it at any point right away kind of inform you about your parents' restaurant? Like, did you go back and were you sort of like a know-it-all? Like, yeah, I'm working at Mistral now, so let me tell you guys about labeling and how to organize the walk-in and everything. Like, did you get like a little bit of a big head now that you were at a sort of a fancy restaurant?
No, I was definitely, I was very like, I mean, I was a kid, you know, and there were like these, you know, heroes like cooking all this stuff, and I was just very like a little, I was very shy, you know, just very like, oh, yes. And I remember breaking, the chef like walked over. He was never really in the kitchen, but he walked over while we were like prepping for a party. And I reached up to get something and a plate comes like crashing down, you know, on the prep table. It was like mise en place there. And he just like got right in my face, you know, and he was just like, are you, you know. And I was just like, oh, what did he say? He was just like, are you... you know, are you like breaking my shit or whatever? And I was like, no. And he was like, no, like no chef. And like from then on, I was like, oh, everything is like, yes, chef, no chef. And I that's that really stuck with me. And then,
yeah.
But I you know, I didn't go back to my family all. You know, maybe after, you know, while I was in culinary school, that happened. It's the same as like when you learn to drive, you know, and then you get in the car with like your mom or your dad, and you're like, your signal's not on, and they're like, shut the hell.
It's like when you after your first year in college, you're the smartest person in the history of the world. Yeah. You're like, let me tell you about World War II. I know everything now. So you are at Mistral. You are learning all this great kind of technique. Was there a specific moment when you got to like jump on the line or cook something where you really was there a turning point at Mistral where you felt like you went from kind of like just doing prepping and being sort of a errand boy around the kitchen to like making real strides and contributions?
It took me a long time to get over that hurdle. And like when I work with younger cooks now, I tell them that I'm like, listen, like one day it's just gonna click and you're gonna be like, this is how things work, and I don't have to be like a scared little puppy at work, you know? But I was definitely like a, you know, it was very intimidating.
You were that. So now you know, for a long time. Now you know how to kind of move people past that point. Yeah. We're here with Jay Chan. He is the chef and owner of Fancy Nancy. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about moving to Montreal. Stick with us.
And this one is called King of Kings by Knife Show. We'll be right back.
Chefs and restaurants are proud of the food they put on the table. And serving produce that comes from local, environmentally responsible farms is a way to leave an even better taste in everyone's mouth. So when shopping for your ingredients, look for the New York State Grown and Certified seal. It lets you know which food is grown right here in New York State, certifying the food that comes from local farms that meet a higher standard. You'll not only be serving local food, you'll be supporting local farmers. Learn more about the New York State Grown and Certified program at certified.ny.gov.
Welcome back to The Line. We're here today with Jay Chan. He is the chef and co-owner of Fancy Nancy. He grew up in Newton, Massachusetts, where his family owns two Pan-Asian Chinese-style restaurants. Yeah. He started cooking at a very young age. He worked at his high school sort of restaurant-slash-home-ec type of situation. And then after that, he, at 16 years old, worked at Mistral in Boston. He then went on to culinary school at Johnson & Wales. And then at a certain point, you moved to Montreal. I want to know what drew you to Canada, and where did you work in Montreal?
So I did at Johnson & Wales. It's a trimester, for one of your trimesters, your second year, you got to go on like an internship somewhere. And I had really no idea where to go, but my aunt and uncle were, you know, they would go to Montreal often. They lived in Boston, but they would go to Montreal often. I think they have like some business there with a hotel, but,
I like that you have no idea what that is.
It's okay. It's all good. They were like, oh, the restaurants are great here. We keep going to this one. It's like beautiful. And, you know, you should come check it out. So I went with them for a trip, and we went to this restaurant called Brunoise, which is no longer there. But it was cool. It was the chef's name is Michel Ross, and he had trained with Gordon Ramsay in London and then worked at, you know, various restaurants in Montreal, opened Brunoise, and it was like a... you know, kind of like a farm to table. It was fine dining, but very affordable kind of neighborhood restaurant, like a prefix menu. And it was awesome. And I was like, sure, why not? I'll go there. So I did my internship there. That was for like 3-4 months. And I had a lot of fun in Montreal. So I just stayed for the summer and worked at another restaurant called La Colombe, which was an awesome experience. I got to become really close with the chef owner there. That was like a tiny, it was me and him on the line, and it was probably a 40 seat restaurant. And that was also a prefix, which helps. So, you know, like the rhythm is a lot easier for prefix. But that was awesome. He like specialized in a lot of game meats.
A lot of French technique at both those places.
Yeah.
Brunoise was
a little more modern. Mm-hmm. La Colombe is very like traditional. You get your like meat and he was serving like a celeriac potato puree, and like haricot vert, you know?
Yeah.
It was awesome. Montreal is great. I always tell people to go to Montreal.
Yeah. For people who haven't been to Montreal, it's obviously a very cosmopolitan city. Mm-hmm. It has a huge amount of blending culture, a rich diversity of food. It's also has a huge amount of French speakers, mm-hmm. as well. Was that a bit of a culture shock at all to you to go up there?
For sure. I took French in school, and was horrible at it. But when I got to Montreal, I lived in both of the restaurants I worked in were in like the French area. So that's where I lived, and like going to the grocery store, everything was in French, and like the people who worked there spoke French, and it was like no English. So I found myself actually picking it up, just like remembering a lot of stuff in school. It was pretty sweet.
So our lives here align a little bit. We both worked at Mile End.
Yeah.
You obviously spent time in Montreal. For those of you listening that don't know, there is an area of Montreal called Mile End. It is the Jewish area. Well, it was the Jewish area. Now I think it's kind of like the Williamsburg, I guess, maybe.
Sure.
A little bit.
Yeah.
When you came back, you worked at Moss Farmhouse, but I actually want to kind of jump forward to Mile End.
Sure.
Because you were basically like the opening guy there for all intensive purposes, right? You went the first week to eat, and then what happened?
I went the first week to eat. I was super psyched about it opening.
Like it had just opened.
Yeah, opened. I went in, it was jammed. I mean, it's like 18 seats, right? It was jammed. You know, I got my seat at the end of the counter, and I was looking around. And at that point, Noah had opened it. Noah and Ray had opened it with like their college friends and like his bandmates, you know. And I was looking around and like, whatever. Not to talk shit, but like they were just kind of like a lot of people were just like standing around, you know, because they really have no restaurant experience. But that was like very charming about the space, and everyone was just like so fucking hip, and like it was awesome. And I was like, are you hiring by any chance? You know, Noah was like slicing meat. I was sitting right in front of him, and I was like, is there any chance you guys are like looking for help? Because I think I can help, you know. And he was like, well, maybe. He was like, come back with like a resume or something. And I took the G home and like went right back with my resume. And I was like, please let me do this, because like I love Montreal. I love this place. And you know, I think I can help, you know, maybe put some systems in the place.
It's so awesome that you came there, because it seems like you were, you know, you had the restaurant background, which Noah had not worked in a restaurant previously. He just had these really delicious recipes that he was cultivating. And so you start on the line there, and are you working with Diana at that point? Who are Michael Stokes? I mean, I'm name dropping here because I used to work at Mile End, obviously. So these are all people that I worked with. So who was the kind of the opening team that had a little bit of restaurant experience that you were working with there?
Me.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't really anyone else. There was someone who was working there who was kind of like helping consult a little bit.
Uh-huh.
His name was also Noah, but he wasn't like around very much. So I was there, and then I don't even remember how we got hooked up with James Merker, but he showed up and...
And he's now in charge of all Russ and Daughters.
Yeah, yeah. But James was awesome, and that was, like, really fun to kind of have that, like, camaraderie now with someone who, you know, is okay with, like, talking shit and, like, grabbing ass a little bit. and then I honestly don't remember if Stokes or Diana got hired first, but I think they maybe started around the same time.
So what's that transition like when you come into a restaurant that just explodes onto the scene? I mean, it was crazy. There were lines around the block.
Yes.
People were dying for this product. It was like the Cronut before the Cronut, right?
Yeah, it was
crazy. Really, really
On weekends, there would be people who drove from, like, Long Island to, like, Hoyt Street, you know, and, like, double parked and was like, where's the pastrami?
And they're
like,
walking by it because it's a little yeah. shoebox on Hoyt Street in Boreham Hill. And everyone's like, where's this deli? Everyone's looking for Katz's. And it's like an old auto garage that Noah converted into this smoked meat dreamland.
Yeah.
So you start there. What does it feel like to kind of jump into a project that is not really established yet? Like, you have your fingers in it, but it's obviously someone else's vision, but sort of you have the cooking background. You bring sort of the actually traditional restaurant skill set into the mix. How does that factor in?
Well, so at that point I was pretty young. I don't even remember how old I was. 23 or something. I was pretty young. But I think at that point it was really great for me because it was like kind of new. We were kind of like growing together. You know, I was still growing as like a cook and a chef. And it was really like I knew I was able to kind of get people to work and not like kind of stand around and like have people wait, you know. So I knew I could help kind of just like get the wheels on track a little bit, you know, as far as getting the place to run a little bit more efficiently. You know, the recipes were all Noah's, and it was great. And I really loved eating the food, you know, so it was easy to get into it, to sell it. People were obviously already excited about it on their own, you know, so... it was an easy sell.
It's cool. We had the exact same experience working in trying to acquire a job there because I went there, had a sandwich, and I looked over at my brother and said, I got to work here.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah,
and
that's great.
The same thing happened
it's
to you.
Sandwich, man.
It's, I think that really speaks to the power of what like a singular flavor can do to people.
Yeah, totally.
It just draws you in, and then you want to know, as a cook, you want to know how to make it, but also you see the kind of direct joy that it's providing people by eating something that it's a sandwich, right? It's a simple item. Did you find that after working in Montreal and doing kind of high end and then coming to, it really is, you know, it's a deli, it's a sandwich shop, which is, definitely not high end, but takes a lot of work on the back end.
Yeah.
Did that transition inform your style at all? Did you draw anything from that big jump?
If anything, yeah, for sure. I was into it. I mean, when I was in Montreal, I would eat at Schwartz's at least once a week, you know, like I had 2 days off and at least one of them.
Schwartz is the very famous Montreal smoked
Jewish
meat
deli
shop.
There.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was already like, oh, smoked meat in Brooklyn. But, I think, kind of seeing how, first of all, seeing how it was run with people who not even like without fine dining. I mean, to me, fine dining was like where you had to be in restaurants, you know, when I was younger. But just seeing how it was run with like people who actually had no experience at all and being like, this is they're doing it and people are excited, and like you don't have to have, you know, crazy chefs yelling and all this stuff. And it was really like refreshing to see like a successful business you know, run by like a very chill atmosphere, you know. So that was great.
After Mile End, something very critical happens. You meet Chris.
I meet Kristen Walker.
Where do you meet? And sort of, what is that next step that you take in your career?
So after Mile End, I left Mile End and I spent some time doing like a supper club. Sounds kind of somehow cliche, but...
it's cool. You were doing supper clubs before other people were doing supper clubs. You invented the
oh, yes,
fad.
Of course,
it's
yes.
Fine.
I coined the phrase. It kind of became my job. We were like selling these tickets and doing like blind tastings out of apartments. But that got very, you know, tiring pretty quick. And so I started working at Northern Spy Food Company in the East Village. That's where Kristen was the general manager. And I was just, cooking on the line. And we met there. That was actually a really great experience, Northern Spy. That's actually no longer open now, but I really love that restaurant. A lot of people feel the same way. Really sad to see it go, but that was also like kind of like refined technique, but the atmosphere was very, not turn and burn, but just a very casual East Village restaurant. So I think about that experience a lot when I'm cooking.
So you and Kristen start thinking about working together in some capacity, but it doesn't happen right away. You end up working with Jonathan and John Wells at Fung Tu.
Yeah.
I had Jonathan on the program. I find him to be as sort of like intelligent, articulate, and passionate as really any chef that I've ever encountered.
Yeah. He's like a very academic.
Yeah, his just knowledge and his ability to discuss like the composite of a dish and the mindset, I found very, very enlightening. What was it like to work with him and also another great talent, John Wells? It's pretty much just the three of you guys in the kitchen trying to get Fung Tu open. I would love to hear about that experience of starting, really jumping in again at the beginning of another restaurant project.
Yeah,
what that was like.
That was another great experience. I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to help them open. I met John Wells at Moss Farmhouse, so we had known each other for a number of years and worked very closely together. We actually did a bunch of the supper club dinners together. So we're very close friends. He met Jonathan while Jonathan was doing pop-ups, I think maybe at Bowery Station. John was like, the food is great. I want in. Let's do this together. And so he called me and was like, we're opening this restaurant. It's going to be awesome. I need you. Like, we want to rock it out. And they didn't really have anyone else in mind for the kitchen. And so I was, yeah, I mean, it was great because at that time we already knew we wanted to do something, Kristen and I. Having the opportunity to like go through an opening kind of emotionally and physically, was a great opportunity to do it.
Did it prepare you at all for what would come with Fancy Nancy, or did you?
Oh yeah. Because, so we signed the lease for Fancy while I was still at Fung Tu. So, we opened it pretty soon after. So everything was still very fresh in my mind, and I would just, while we were opening, I probably thought about Fung Tu like, 50% of my day. I was just like, thinking back and like, okay, this is very doable. And, it was a great experience. Yeah.
It's so cool that you were able to do that kind of simultaneously, be part of the process of opening Fung Tu and also working on Fancy Nancy, mm-hmm. because, it seems like you were able to do a ton of cooking, but also able to sort of lean on someone who is going through that same process.
Yeah.
And someone that you could trust as well. So, so Kristen is managing Mission Cantina. You're at Fung 2 and you're working on the build out of Fancy Nancy. You've got about a million things going on. What day did you open Fancy Nancy?
We opened August 22nd of last year, 2015, and it was a very, we just kind of like opened the doors to the neighborhood. We didn't like make a big deal of the opening. It was just like, we'll just see who comes in, and because I actually had a lot of trouble getting staff to open, so we opened with, it was me and one of the cooks was a 22-year-old who had just graduated college, who had never, she was actually used to be in radio. She had never worked in a restaurant before, you know, but she was just interested in food. And I was like, that's all I need. Like, you're passionate about food and you have a heartbeat. Let's do this. One of the other cooks was also, I think maybe she was 24 at the time, didn't really work at restaurants either, but she was Danny Bowen's babysitter. And I was like, that's close enough. Let's do this. So yeah, I definitely did not want to get caught with my pants down. I was like, let's just quietly open this place, you know. So it was very smooth, and then it's definitely evolved. We opened with like six things on the menu, you know, yeah, it's come a long way in our first year for sure.
I'm gonna read a quote from you about the restaurant. We treat the restaurant as an extension of our home. When you walk through the door, you aren't greeted by a traditional restaurant experience. What I always tell our team is to imagine a house party. Chris and I throw a party every single night. So that resonates with me incredibly hard as someone who opened up a restaurant a week ago and has been looking forward to that dream for a really long time.
Nice. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you very much. Awesome. I think partly why I love Fancy Nancy so much is for what you've just articulated in that quote. It feels like Cheers with food and cocktails, you know, like it is in fact a neighborhood spot.
Yeah.
It feels so often when you go out to restaurants these days that people are trying to create a neighborhood spot, but you can just smell it from a mile away that it just doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
How did you pull it off? How did you create the vibe, and how do you continue to cultivate that as you expand the menu?
The vibe, I have, you know, we got to give credit to Kristen. She is a lot of the restaurant, you know, and a lot of the experience is really her. But we live in the neighborhood, you know, so we knew we wanted to open something not necessarily in that neighborhood, but it just kind of clicked. You know, one day we were like, I'm just so sick of like ordering the same things on Seamless and like going to these places that don't really have that many options. I want to eat some vegetables or something. And we were like, let's just do it here, you know? And so we started looking around for spaces, you know, in the neighborhood. But people always know when you're not being real, you know? And so if you're trying to, it's almost like they want to open a neighborhood restaurant, but it's like a neighborhood themed restaurant.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And a lot
it's
of
like,
that,
what are the
is,
10 pieces you yeah, need to yeah. make a neighborhood restaurant? Let's get them all crammed into this room.
Yeah, exactly. You know? But it's really, it's just about being honest to that, attitude. Like, I really hate when you go to restaurants and the server has like a server voice, you know, cause it's like, I know you're going to clock out and you're going to like hit up your friends, and that's not how you're going to talk to your friends. Like, just talk to me like a real person, you know, because, so, you know, that's, you know, we always remind our staff of that, and, the staff is really great, you know, so that's, you know, a lot of it is up to them, but, yeah, I don't know.
I want to also ask you about specifically Bed-Stuy, which is a rapidly changing neighborhood in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
New businesses are opening up all the time. You live there.
Yeah.
I live there. You opened up a year ago. I moved to Bed-Stuy about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
As Bed-Stuy changes, and people that have lived there for a long time have been often critical of the changing demographics, you do live there and you do have a business there. You are as much a part of that community now. How do you see Fancy Nancy fitting into that? And how do you see Bed-Stuy sort of changing over the next couple of years?
Oh, well, I mean, I think we fit in simply because we are genuinely a neighborhood restaurant, you know. Everything on our menu is under $20, which if you're a neighborhood restaurant and you expect people to eat there often, like, it's kind of fucked up to, you know, to, like, serve a, you know, $36 chicken or whatever. But, you know, and we want people to come back. And the neighborhood's been great. You know, we probably recognize, like, 80% of the faces that walk through the door, you know, which is... We're very lucky and very grateful for the neighborhood. But a lot of people are moving in. And how's the neighborhood going to change? Well, I mean, there's definitely room for more restaurants and cafes and stuff to open. So, you know, that's really great for the neighborhood. There's restaurants and cafes opening up now, which is, like, awesome to see, because as much as we have a business there, we also live there and want to eat more food too, you know. That's I don't know. I really like it. It's very chill, and we'll see. I hope it doesn't get crazy, like, you know, Williamsburg style, but it's still very chill for now.
We have to wrap up really shortly, but I do want to ask you about one specific dish on the menu, the chicken dish.
Sure.
If you can just briefly explain it. I know that it has been influenced by your mom. I think it's such a wonderful representation of the restaurant.
Nice.
It's a great chicken dish. It's a thing that you can order a lot, and of course it is under $20 as well, which I think makes it appealing to the neighborhood. What's this dish about?
The restaurant is named after my mom. And so I was like, well, I gotta have a dish that's just, like, for mom, you know? So it was really just, I thought of all the things she really likes to eat. She loves, I worked at this place in Boston, in Newton, actually, that had, like, a roast chicken that she loves. So I knew it would just be, like, a roast chicken. That's an easy, that's an easy sell. And then she loves when we eat chicken, like the poached, like, Chinatown chicken that's just, like, hanging there. It's the condiment is like a ginger scallion sauce, which I also love. So we do brick chicken is the technique. So we debone. You get a half chicken. It's completely deboned except for, like, the drumstick and, you know, and the wing, you know, the little wing drumstick, hot pan, skin side down. You know, a brick on top that's wrapped in foil, very technical. And it basically cooks on one side the whole way. We take the chicken out to rest, and then all these kind of, like, rendered, fats and juices are there. And instead of making a pan sauce, we make a pan, we call it a pan rice. So it's basically like a fried rice that's, you know, fried with the chicken fat that's rendered off the roasted chicken. So, we throw some sliced garlic, there's rice and kale, and it's really just kale fried rice. It's those three things. It's like chicken, rice, and condiment, and the neighborhood is eating it up, and my mom comes for brunch. She'll, like, visit for brunch for the day, but I'll, like, roast her chicken, you know.
What'd she say the first time she visited the restaurant and when you said, "Mom, this is named after you"?
She loves it, obviously, but she was like, "How do you get the rice so good?" And I was like, "Yes, you know, victory. That's all I need to hear. We can just close now."
My mom finally approves of me. I've made it.
Yeah, but it was great. I love cooking that dish, and it's great. It's a really fun dish. And if you come to the restaurant, I definitely recommend the chicken.
Jay, congratulations on year one.
Thank you.
Thank you for being on the line.
Thanks for having me.
Heritage Radio listeners, thank you for joining us. Join us every week, Tuesday at 11 a.m. here on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.